Last time we began to look at Paul's addressing the question of what the significance of law is, given the fact that it doesn't have a direct impact on our participation in the inheritance. Verse 18 of chapter 3 of Galatians says the inheritance is not based on the law, because if it was, God could not have given it to Abraham by promise. And the whole issue of the inheritance is the crucial big ticket issue. That's how everything's going to come out in the end. It's the inheritance that is the final state of affairs that men will enter into in relation to the promise of eternal life. And of course, the magnitude of that as an inheritance is given its a greater degree of magnitude by its alternative, and that is eternal death. And so we have this reality of the final state of things. And Paul just point blankly says, if the inheritance was based on the law, it's not based on the promise, but God gave it to Abraham by means of a promise. So our participation is not affected by legal issues. So that automatically raises the question in verse 19, what is the law? And what purpose or function does it serve in light of its identity? So in our first study last week, we noted that the essence of law is its identity as a revelation of the justice of God and man's abysmal lack of conformity to it. In other words, the law is a revelation of the truth about God in His glory in terms of justice, fundamentally justice. And then it was imposed on men so that they would recognize how inept they are at trying to even live in an approximate way that would be in harmony with the law. The whole point, according to this paragraph in verse 18 and following, is that the purpose of this identity as a revelation of God's justice and man's abysmal failure is to force men to return to the ancient promises as a methodology for living. Because the issue of the inheritance, the issue of life, the issue of eternal life, all of this is all about how well or how poorly we relate to the God who made us, and in a real relationship. So that the issue of relationship with God, the issue of a relationship between God and a human being or a person, a created person, has to have a workable methodology. And Paul's argument in Galatians is the methodology's promise coupled to faith. And it's completely skewed and messed up when law and obedience are put into that mix. So, in general, what we find is that Paul's argument is that the scripture is a tutor. Verse 23, before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith that was later to be revealed, so that the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ. In other words, the function of law is to force us to go back to an earlier methodology that actually works, because the law does not work as a methodology of relationship. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look at some more things that Paul said in verse 19 that we didn't get to finish last time that have to do with Paul's description of the origins of the law, and we're going to ask ourselves what his point might be in saying these things about it. In fact, I was a little bit disconcerted by the fact that what he had to say here was not part of my education background. When he says that the law was ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator, I've read that before. I've heard statements about that before, but I've never heard any kind of a detailed study of the fact that the law didn't come off the hand of God. In fact, I was in the impression that the Ten Commandments were inscribed by the finger of God on a piece of rock. And I'm familiar with those passages where Moses' opposition was held accountable by God when he said, "How is it that you are not afraid to argue with my servant Moses, whom I speak with face to face," and everybody else kind of gets it in mutterings and dark sayings. And so the Old Testament focus has always been that the law is the law of God, and He's the one who gave it.
And yet Paul comes right along and says it was ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator. So we have to ask ourselves, what's he trying to do here? And I think clearly, in light of the fact that in Galatians he is adamantly opposed to any suggestion that the law is an effective relational mechanism. It is not. It's clear that Paul is trying to downplay law. He wants to make it, in its most appealing form, a tutor to bring us to Christ. It's the handmaid to promise. And to try to make the law a mechanism that will enable a healthy relationship between God and man is a bad idea, because it will not work. It cannot work. Law creates rebellion, and it sponsors sin, and it is death to relationship. Relationships that are rooted in, I've done this for you, so you owe me this, are just about a step and a half away from divorce. I mean, relationships that are rooted in, you owe me because I've done for you, or I owe you because you've done for me, those kind of relationships don't have a solid base. They just go to pot. So the whole idea that you can use the law to sponsor a relationship is just a bad idea. It's true that when the law was established on Mount Sinai, it had an extremely impressive beginning. There was thunder and darkness and lightning and terror. That's kind of Hebrews 12:21. You know, even Moses said, I'm scared spitless here. You'll never, ever have a healthy, good working relationship that's built on terror. That doesn't fly. So the law was impressive in its initial beginning, but it was a terror thing, and it did have a long run historically, 1300 to 1500 years. And in contrast, promise given to Abraham, but basically beginning to spin down as an effective method, it came off as weak and effective as soon as Abraham's exploits kind of dimmed in the memory of the people. If promise is such a good way to relate, how come it didn't work better? The whole issue is, what are we dealing with? Paul's argument is that inheritance in the eternal kingdom of the great God of glory is rooted exclusively in promise. And law not only strips a person of such an inheritance — you cannot get an inheritance through the law, it'll strip that away — but it'll actually destroy anybody who seeks to gain it by that means. If you approach God on the basis of justice and law, you will be cast into outer darkness. So when he is addressing the issue of the law in verses 19 and following, one of the things that he's having to struggle with is the human default since Genesis 3 to the issues of obedience and demand. That's the human default. We come into this world with this default already in place. All of us that are parents know that kids have to have law applied. They have to have this tutor, because the whole issue of promise and obedience out of love, that's so foreign to a kid. Kids don't obey their parents because they love them. They obey their parents because their parents make them. And that's the origins of human thought about how relationships work. So a person grows up, the notion is that God's a demander and you have to obey him. And if you don't, there's hell to pay. Well, the problem is, if you don't, there is hell to pay. But the fact is, you can't. So there's hell to pay. So we're dealing with some things that some very fundamental issues. Root level is that God has made some promises. He made them to Abraham and to Christ. And he's willing to include us in the effective fruit of those promises if we're willing to be placed into Christ through the process of belief, faith, believing in the gospel. So in verse 19, we're going to look at this description of Paul, the description he makes in terms of the establishment of the law. Keep in mind, he said it came 430 years after promise, And it was only supposed to last until the seed should come to whom the promises were made, which is Christ. So the law was always intended to be a temporary insertion in the plan. And it was brought in, according to verse 19, because of the problem of transgressions. So that's what Paul has been saying. Now, in respect to that, he says that the law was added having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator. Now, what in the world does he mean by that? He's talking about ordained. That word translated ordained simply means the act of laying something out as an operating principle of a given reality. The way the word's used in the New Testament, if something's ordained, that means that somebody has set certain principles of operation as the way that things are to be done. Paul used the term, for example, when he was instructing Titus on how to order the church and get it structured and all that, and he said, these things I ordained for the churches. Well, all that means is I told you how to do it. This is the way it's done. The New Testament used the term when Jesus was giving instructions to his disciples, and he was laying out some things for their understanding, and it says when he finished commanding, but it's this word, ordaining these things. So the idea is the law was set out as a basis for some kind of functional capacity, some operating principle, but the interesting thing about it is that this ordination was done by angels. It was established through angels. And as I said, I never gave that any serious thought till this week. Well, last week when I was studying for the last time and we didn't get around to it. We've already pointed out that Paul has already established that the law is both late and temporary. It came after a promise of 430 years and it was temporary. It was only to last until Jesus had come. So, when we talk about operating principles of a given reality, the thing that we have to ask is, what's the given reality that the law was established to facilitate this given reality? Well, at the most fundamental level, the law was given on Sinai as the constitution of a national entity. In other words, Israel was being created by the giving of the law as a national entity. It was going to be a nation. God had promised Abraham that he would make of him a great nation. The giving of the law at Sinai was, in a sense, the constitution and bylaws of the new nation. So the nation was created at the institution of the law at Sinai. Now they knew how the nation was supposed to function. God was the king, and the people were the people of the kingdom of the God. So that the whole issue of this kingdom was that they were going to be a national entity on the earth among other nations, but they were going to be unique in that the God who created the earth and all those other nations was going to be their king in their national structure. So that it was going to be focused on them as a nation. And the people of the kingdom had certain responsibilities in relation to their king, and the king had certain responsibilities that he committed himself to meeting for the people. So he would tell them, now, as your king, this is what I expect, and as my people, this is what you can expect from me. And that's basically the way the law was set out. But it was fundamentally a national entity that would function in this world as a mediated theocracy. In other words, God's going to be the king, but he wasn't going to be the most visible ruler. It's a mediated theocracy. God would be the king, the Israelites would be the inhabitants of the kingdom, but the interactions of the king in respect to the inhabitants in his kingdom, as well as their relationships to the inhabitants of the other kingdoms, those were all going to be determined by the issue of law. Sinai, the law given, this is the way it's going to work. These are the principles that are going to govern this national structure. All of the applications of that law, though, were going to be executed through what I call a tiered mediation that had its most visible form in the priesthood, where, in a very real sense, God kept himself isolated. He was in a tent. He was in an inner sanctum of a tent that kept everybody in the whole kingdom from ever seeing him, except the high priest one time a year went into the holiest of all. So God was present in the tent, but the only indication you ever had that that was true was maybe the glow of the Shekinah and in the dark, or the smoke in the daytime. But as far as being able to go to the king and seek out whatever, didn't happen. Instead, it was mediated. You had a high priest who was the main guy, and he could go in to see the king once a year on the Day of Atonement. But other than that, he couldn't even go in there. And yet, he was only one man, and so there were going to be a whole tribe of men who were going to be priests under this priest, and they would carry out all of the functions of the mediated theocracy, where whatever God wanted would be distributed among the people in terms of the priesthood. In conjunction with the priests, however, there was always somebody else. When God chose Moses, he intended for Moses to be his spokesman, and that was going to be the, but Moses threw up such a oppositional complaint that God said, okay, well, I'll let your brother be involved in this, so Aaron can be your mouth. And they made the priesthood out of Aaron. But the priesthood that Aaron functioned at, and Aaron was the high priest, in the initial setting of the kingdom, Moses was as much a representative of the will of God as the high priest was, if not more so. And then, of course, when Moses died, you had some other significant person who became, he wasn't the high priest, but he was a very dominant ruling element of the kingdom. You had Joshua, and after Joshua, you had all the judges. God would raise up individual combination kind of prophet judge, and the prophet judge was never the high priest. But they worked together to make sure that the nation understood what the will of God was and what God wanted them to do as a national entity. And that's the way it was set up to function as. It was a mediated theocracy where human beings were in the place of God for the rest of the people. And we still have a lot of people who think that's the way it is today. You go to another human being in order to find out what the will of God is and get your blessings from God through another human being and so on. So it's still the whole notion of a priesthood, even if the people aren't called priests. But they normally are when you have this mediated notion. The reality that the law was supposed to establish the principles for the function of that given reality was a national, theocratic, mediated kingdom on this earth where God more or less kept himself isolated, but he used individuals within the kingdom to make sure that the rest of the individuals in the kingdom understood what he wanted. Now, in Paul's statement in verse 19, when he says that the law was laid out in terms of operating principles, it was done by, he said, angels and a mediator. So you have angels and a mediator. And the whole scenario of law then had its origins in this idea of a mediated theocracy. Because according to Paul's words, God did not do this directly. God used angels to do this and a mediator. So given that, the outcome is going to be whatever that initial thing was. And the initial thing was, God's not doing this, the angels are. And the mediator. So what's the result going to be? Well, the result's going to be a kind of second-hand, and, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood here, but it's in a very real sense, a kind of second-hand relationship where you really don't have a relationship one-on-one with God. You have several steps down. If you're not the high priest, you never even see this God. If you're not of the priesthood, you don't even get anywhere close. And if you're just Joe Blow Jew from the tribe of Dan or whatever, your relationship with your king is all kinds of distance from God. That, Paul says, is the essence of the law. It's a mediated theocratic reality that angels kicked into gear. Now, that means then that the whole scenario of law was never, by design, was never capable of producing a one-on-one relationship between God and man, or a God and a human individual. You couldn't have this direct connection by the law. It wasn't available to you. It was never intended to be. So that not only was the ongoing function of the law dependent on all these levels of mediation, its origins were directly angelic and indirectly divine. Now, you have to say, well, Paul, you were a Pharisee, you were a representative of law, legal Jewish theology for the first 30 years of your life. Do you really want to go down this path and just say the law is angelic? Well, that's what he's doing, verse 19. Now, for myself, the biblical record, as far as I can tell, it's unspecific about how many angels were involved. And the emphasis in the Old Testament record upon the law is that it's the king's instrument of rule. And the notion or the idea that it's an indirect divine thing is just pretty well glossed over so that you never even think about it. I never did. How in the world could Paul reduce the law to an angelic thing? And keep this in mind. The instruments that God chooses to use seldom can go beyond their own capacities. And what I mean by that is this. What did the angels know about the God whom they were representing when they established the law in respect to all of the things that we understand based on New Testament revelation? I mean, how much did they understand the grace of God, having never seen it? How much did they understand about the mercy? I mean, they got the justice thing. They were either observers or participants in the angelic rebellion, and they saw how God responded to that. And so, you know, okay, we got this justice thing. We pretty well understand the holiness of God. If those kind of people, and I use the word people in terms of created personalities, are the ones who are laying this thing out, they're not going to go beyond where they're able to go. So Peter says that in relation to the gospel and the fact that God would send his son to die for human sinners was so off the chart as far as the angels was concerned that Peter said the angels desired to look into this because this just blew their minds. They'd never even thought that God could be anywhere at all like what they witnessed when the Son of God descended into the human thing and took on human flesh and then put up with all of the garbage that was dumped on him by these arrogant human beings who thought that they were the masters of their universe. The angels watched all that with their mouths open. I mean, and they wanted to look into this. And then when they heard the preaching of the apostles that were inspired and guided by the Holy Spirit of God who was dwelling in these human bodies now, that's something that angels had never experienced. They'd never experienced the Spirit of God dwelling in them. So they didn't have and they heard this doctrine, they heard these truths, and they longed to look into it because this represented a picture of God they didn't have a clue about. And if they didn't have a clue about it, and they're the ones who established the law, guess what? The law wasn't going to have a clue about it either. And it didn't. That's why Paul says, you can't get there from here if relationship with God is what's in your mind and you're going to use law to do it. It won't work. It can't work. So it's obvious that he's bringing law down from the level that it had held for in men's minds, because he says it was ordained by angels. And even though we don't know how many, we do know that the fact is, Paul is saying this is not directly divine. It was indirectly divine. It was mediated by angels. It's ordained by angels. Now, I want to point out three passages, two of them in Acts 7, that we've all read. And then I want to make a comment about why we didn't understand it when we read it. Acts 7:38, Stephen is preaching in Acts 7, a sermon's going to get him killed. So he's laying it on these Jewish, arrogant, self-righteous blasphemers who had set themselves up as God in the place of God for all the people of Israel. And he says to them, in reference to Moses in verse 37, he says in verse 38, "This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai, and who was with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you." So Moses got it from an angel. In 7:53, in the continuation of this sermon, he says, verse 52, "Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. And you who received the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it." So here, twice in the sermon that got him killed, Stephen says that the law came through the agency of angels. And then to cap it, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 2. Very strong argument in the book of Hebrews about the superiority of Christ as the Son of God, because one of the big things that author Hebrews does in Hebrews is to take the angels down a notch. Just like Paul is taking the law down a notch or two in Galatians, the author of Hebrews, knowing in what high regard angels were held by Jews, he started off his book by taking the angels down a notch. And he says, "To whom has God ever said to an angel, 'You are my son, today I've begotten you, and I'll be a father to you, and you'll be a son to me.'" He never said that to an angel. He's taking them down a notch. But notice what he says in Hebrews 2:2. "If the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation?" The so great a salvation is the salvation that's rooted in the Son, who's superior to the angels, chapter 1. "After it was at first spoken through the Lord, and then confirmed to us by those who heard, and God bearing witness with them with signs and wonders," and so on. The point is, in Hebrews 2:2, it point blankly says the law was spoken by angels. He is not diminishing its authority, because he says in Hebrews 2:2 that every transgression received a just recompense. So he's not saying that you can ignore it with impunity. You can't. But you do need to understand that the law, that everybody in the false teaching that was coming into Galatia, the law was for them the way you relate to God. And Paul is saying, no, it is not. And one of his lines of proof is, it couldn't be. It was ordained by angels. It's a mediated theocracy. It's a distance from God thing. And anything that comes out of distance is going to create distance. Now, Paul is not in Galatians 3:19. Trying to diminish the authority of the law, because Hebrews 2:2 is as plain as it can be. Every time you break it, pow, there's a consequence. Every disobedience received a recompense. And Paul is also not directly attacking the use of mediators by God. He's not faulting God for using mediators, because the entire scenario of God's dealings with men in respect to Israel, the church, the kingdom that's to come, all of these realities heavily
relate to the idea of God using instruments to mediate his blessings to others. In other words, in the church, for example. We're supposed to be agents of blessing to one another. The things that God has given to us by his Spirit, the gifts that he's given to us, we're supposed to use for each other's sake. Well, now, isn't God in that? Well, sure he is. But isn't it mediated? Sure it is. But what's the difference in the issue of God using mediators now and in the kingdom? I mean, the whole issue of the kingdom, Jesus said, I'll make you rulers over cities and, you know, I'll set you up on thrones over the 12 tribes. And all of that, again, Christ is the king, but the rule of Christ is going to be mediated through the whole entire eternal kingdom scenario. Everybody's going to have their place and everybody's going to be impacting everybody else and all the things. This is God in mediation. He's doing an intermediate type of thing. So what's really going on here? Why is Paul so adamant that the law is an ineffective mediation of blessing when mediation of blessing is a fundamental characteristic of God's use of... I mean, let's suppose that God decided that he had never used an intermediate agent. He was always going to do everything himself. So that the only thing you would ever get from him would be something he did directly for you. And you could never do anything for anybody else that would be beneficial. He would do it. What would that reduce your participation in his life to? Nothing. You wouldn't have any participation. You'd be on the receiving end of his direct activity toward you, but there would be no outgo. There would be no flow outward to anybody else because you couldn't do it. God, I'm not going to use anybody. I'm just going to do it myself. Bang, bang, bang. So everybody gets to receive from God directly, but nobody gets to receive from anybody else. And it's not just the receiving, it's the giving. So you can't participate in his life if he doesn't allow you to be an instrument in his hands for the blessing of someone else. You can't participate in his life. That's what the essence of life is being useful to God for somebody else's sake. So we're not saying that Paul was attacking the use of mediators. What he's doing is, he is revealing that the imposition of the law was not the real issue of the mediation of life. What was the methodology of the mediation of life? It was promised. So that when God made a promise and you believed it, you got to participate. And the law came 430 years later and couldn't improve on that. Because the issue was, he makes promises, you believe them, you get to participate. The law makes demands, you can't obey them, so what do you get? You get whacked for disobedience. Well, the whole point there is that Paul is arguing that the law was imposed in a setting of relational distance. It was imposed because of transgressions. There was already this barrier. And Paul is saying that it was set in place through messengers in order to indicate that the law came into being as a totally different covenant in which God used messengers to set it in place. The angelic agency issue we've already seen in Stephen's sermon in Hebrews 2. How come we didn't know this from the Old Testament? Stephen knew it from the Old Testament. Hebrews 2:2 knows it from the... How come we didn't know it? You know why? Because we're always told that the angel of the Lord was a pre-incarnation of Jesus Christ. And so the angel of the Lord was really the Lord. Apparently the Jews didn't see it that way. The angel of the Lord was not the Lord. It was an angel. And even Moses was told, my name will be in him, so you got to be careful how you deal with him. But he's still an angel. He's not me. So I think that's the reason why in Christendom we've lost sight of this thing that the Jews knew, that the law was ordained by angels. But we've been taught that the angel was really the Lord himself, a pre-incarnation of Jesus and Son. And so in a little while, the law was not ordained by angels.
The law came off the hand of God, and
that's really necessary if you're going to use law as a relational methodology. Because you can't relate to somebody who's already got distance between you and him. What did you do before cell phones and texting and computers and telephones and trying to relate to somebody who was 1,000 miles from you? Well, the best thing you could do was to write a letter and send it and wait weeks, maybe months, maybe even years before you got a response. Well, how great was the relationship when that's all the contact you had? Well, it wasn't great. The very fact that Paul is saying here that the law was mediated, it was ordained through angels by the hand or the agency of the hand of a mediator. The whole idea here is there's distance in the relationship. The lack of immediacy indicates distance. And distance in any relationship allows difficulties to multiply. Before you can ever even get an answer to the question that you need to have, weeks have gone by and all of the problems that you had to make all these decisions and yet you got no information. What kind of a deal is that going to be in terms of real relationship? What isn't going to be? It's just distance. The hand of a mediator or the agency of a mediator just increases this issue of distance. Now, it's true that the majority of the uses of the word mediator in the New Testament refer to Jesus Christ. He's the mediator between the Father and human beings. He's the mediator of a new covenant, a better covenant. But the New Testament doctrine of Christ as that mediator is that he's God. So yeah, he's a mediator, but he's not a mediator between God and man. He's a mediator who is God, who can relate directly to the Father and the Spirit so that men who have a relationship with him have a relationship with God. So the mediator concept, when it's applied to Jesus, doesn't fit this thesis in Galatians 3. The thesis in verse 19 is that the law forces distance into any kind of relationship you have with the king of the kingdom. And forced distance means trouble. Moses was the mediator in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 5:5 says so. And it's a position that he didn't shrink from because in Exodus 32:32, when the people had sinned and God was going to destroy them, he stepped into the gap as the mediator and said, if you're not going to forgive their sins, visit the wrath on me. Blot my name out of the book, not theirs. God said, sorry, the ones that sin, they're the ones that get blotted. You're not going to be allowed to step into this gap. But the fact that Moses was denied by God doesn't mean that Moses didn't try to be the mediator that he was in there to be. So my point is, Paul is deliberately establishing in verse 19 that the law cannot work in enhancing our participation in the inheritance in the kingdom of the God who is, because it is a distance-creating reality. It's only existing because of transgressions, which has already created a huge barrier. Therefore, the only conclusion we can come to is that the law is inferior to promise. Even though it did look like, over the 430-year time frame, that promise had kind of lost its pizzazz, and therefore we needed something a little bit with a little more teeth in it. Well, the problem with imposing something with teeth in it is the relationship's already ruptured, and the teeth only bring about condemnation. The only legitimate relationship is a relationship one-on-one where somebody is telling the truth and the other person's believing it. That's promise and faith. Why is this so crucial? Well, go to Romans chapter 4 for a real succinct statement. Romans chapter 4 tells us why it's so absolutely essential that we not go to law as a relational thing. Because it says in Romans 4:16, for this reason it is by faith, that it might be in accordance with grace, in order that the promise may be certain to all their descendants.
not only to those who are of the national structure that's created by the law, but also those that are of the faith of Abraham, who believe like Abraham did. The point that I'm making here is that the promise as a fundamental relational mechanism can only be sure by faith and grace. If you put the law in there, you will destroy the promise. How so? Well, let's say God promises that he's going to make of Abraham a nation. But you stick the law in there. Okay, the law demands that every person who sins dies. Okay, where's this nation going to come from, all these dead people? There's not going to be a nation. It's going to destroy the nation. Because the law was a ministry of condemnation. That's what the New Testament calls it. The law was a motivator of sin. When the law came, sin was stirred up, and the law became the primary strength of sin. So that if you stick the law into the issue of promise, the promise can never be fulfilled because the law will destroy the people that are part of the promise. So in order for the promise to be certain, Paul says, it has to be based on promise and faith. Grace and faith, because at the end of chapter 4, the big issue is promise is kept by the one who makes it. And that's the only way it stands sure. It's sure because God's going to make it happen. As soon as we put the law in it, men become part of it. Men then become agents of destruction of it, and therefore it can't be sure anymore. If it's up to God, it'll be done. If it's up to God and me, it won't be done. So that's the reason why he's so emphatic here. Now, the inferiority of that law in verse 19 of Galatians is to promise doesn't mean the law didn't do its job. It just means the job was different than the promise was. What was promise supposed to do? It was supposed to initiate and maintain a relationship with God one-on-one. He speaks, you believe him. You have an instant connection, relationship. Promise, faith. That was the point. Okay, what was law for? Well, law was only brought in when people had started disbelieving the promise and they were involved in transgressions and they had to be forced back to this principle of promise and faith, and the only way they could be forced back to it is if you imposed on them condemnation so that without faith and promise, they were going to die. So they were pressured by their own failure to look for a better method than it had already been given. When we talk about mediation as an issue, what was really the difference between the priests and the mediators of that covenant for the people of Israel in terms of blessing to them? And the church, where we're all supposed to be instruments of blessing to one another because God's a user of instruments, mediators. What's the main difference? The Spirit of God dwells in every one of our bodies, so that anybody who's blessed by us is actually blessed by the Spirit of Christ producing the life of Christ through our bodies to bring blessing to somebody else. And that's the only way it works. As soon as Daryl gets in the way, you're not blessed. It's only when the Spirit of God, using my body, communicates something of benefit to you that you are blessed. But that's immediate. That's the Spirit of God in me connecting with the Spirit of God in you for your soul's sake. In Israel, how many of them had the Spirit? Maybe the king, but he would come and go. Because even David had to pray, don't take him from me. So you can never be sure. And as a consequence, God's use of mediators was totally different back then. That was a distance issue. Now it's an immediacy issue. And God's going to continue that in the kingdom to come. We're still going to be agents of blessing to one another, but it'll still be God doing it through us and in us. So that's the main difference, and that's the reality of the difference between law and promise. My relationship with God depends on whether I trust him or not. If I don't trust him, I will sin, and then law will step in the mix saying, You deserve to be beat. You deserve to be punished. You deserve it. And the whole thing spins down to a ministry of condemnation. So what Paul is doing in Galatians 3:19 is emphasizing the fact that the law simply cannot stand the pressure of the need of genuine relationship. It was ordained by angels who didn't really understand a good bit of the truth about God. It was ordained through the agency or the hand of a mediator. It created distance, and it was only supposed to last until the seed should come. And that seed was going to be the Son of God himself. And he was going to come and step into the mix immediately and do the thing that promise said had to be done. So even in Jesus, the promise was not kept by some fallible human being. It was kept by the Son of God who did it in our place.